From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and so many things happening today. The impeachment trial resumes in Washington. There are more cases of the coronavirus being reported in the United States. The Iowa caucuses are 1 week from today. And of course, the world is mourning the death of basketball great Kobe Bryant. And nowhere is that more evident than where you are, Tanya, in the Los Angeles area.
Yes, Jeremy, you know, whether you are a basketball fan or not, Kobe Bryant's legacy could be felt in every stretch of this city. He spent his entire career in L.A. His four kids were born here. He was actually on his way to his 13-year-old Gianna's youth basketball academy right when the crash happened. I drove past the big Staples Center sign that read, "We love you, Kobe," and I couldn't help but feel that deep pang in my chest that I first felt when I heard the news. A little later, we'll talk with a Los Angeles native and writer about the impact Kobe had not only on this city, but also on the world.
All right, we look forward to that. But right now, let's get to Washington, where new revelations from former National Security Advisor John Bolton could be changing the dynamics in the Senate impeachment trial. NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez is in Washington and joins us. Franco, the New York Times saw parts of a book that Bolton is writing, and according to the Times, he claims that President Trump told him that he wanted to keep military aid to Ukraine on hold until Ukraine agreed to politically charged investigations, including of Joe Biden. How significant is this development?
It's very significant. It undercuts a key argument by the White House about a quid pro quo. The White House has dismissed this charge because no Democratic witnesses heard from Trump directly, from his own lips, saying that he wanted the aid withheld for investigations into political rivals. Now you have, according to these reports, John Bolton saying he heard from the President Trump himself that he wanted this aid held until the investigations. That's a lot more direct.
So what does this mean for the trial? Utah Republican Senator Mitt Romney said today that it is now increasingly likely that other Republicans will join in calling for Bolton to testify. You'd need four Republicans to join all of the Democrats in order to call witnesses in the trial. Is this a game changer in the trial?
It could be. It certainly is going to open up the conversation, get more people talking. It already is. Susan Collins of Maine released a very similar statement saying that this has generated more conversations about bringing on new witnesses. But we're also hearing from other Republicans, such as Senator Barrasso from Wyoming, saying Bolton is just trying to sell books. Senator Blunt of Missouri saying that nothing has changed. So there is no question this is a big deal. But we've been in this position before where, you know, there were questions about this may be a game changer. And we learn a few days later, it's not so much.
Right. What has been the White House response? And is there a sense that the president's lawyers will change their legal strategy today on day two of their presentation in the Senate trial?
Well, they're likely, as they were before, to argue why they don't need witnesses. We've heard from Republican senators who are just saying, hey, take a breath. Let's wait and see what the White House has to say. But, you know, there's no questions that the senators certainly want to hear from the White House and know what they're going to say. Senator Thune of South Dakota told our colleagues on the Hill that he expects 100 questions during the Q&A period, and that Bolton will sit certainly be one that comes up. I also just want to note that, you know, the White House team still has a lot of other arguments to make about that president had reason to withhold the aid, that money still flowed, that the Ukraine president Zelensky said he didn't feel any pressure. So there's more to be discussed.
There's another development I want to ask you about. Over the weekend, audio emerged of President Trump talking with Lev Parnas, the indicted Rudy Giuliani associate who he's denied knowing, talking with him about removing the former ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, from her post because Parnas claimed she'd been criticizing the president. Let's listen.
Get rid of her.
Hooray. One of the first
things. Get her out tomorrow. I don't care. Get her out tomorrow. Take her out. Okay?
Excellent.
Do it.
Make a note.
How has that gone over?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly, eyebrow-raising. The recording contradicts the president's own statements that he did not know Giuliani's associates like Lev Parnas. You know, Republicans have, sought to challenge Parnas's credibility, noting that he's under an indictment. Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas said he wasn't worried about those tapes. He was speaking on CBS's Face the Nation, and he said that video is more than a year old before Marie Yovanovitch was actually removed, and that the president is within his rights to remove an ambassador for any reason.
So, Franco, can you really have a tape that comes out and contradicts what the president has been saying, and this revelation from John Bolton coming out and contradicting the president and what he's been saying, and then have the Republicans in the Senate just end the trial this week with no witnesses?
I think it puts a lot of pressure on the Republicans to bring in more witnesses. This is a difficult position for them to be in. As we pointed out, Mitt Romney, Susan Collins are certainly calling in. Right. And Democrats are warning them that if they don't, they may have to hear from it when the book actually comes out.
That's NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez. Thank you, Franco.
Thank you.
Let's check in now on the coronavirus. 3,000 people are known to have the virus. Most of them live in China. At least 80 people have died as a result. The epicenter is in Wuhan, a city of 11 million people. And cases are turning up around the world. There are 5 confirmed cases in the U.S. There are some in Hong Kong, too, which is where NPR's Jason Beaubien is. And Jason, what are authorities saying?
So there's a lot of concern here in Hong Kong about the potential for many of these cases from mainland China to come into Hong Kong. They've already shut down anyone who wants to come from Hubei province, which is where Wuhan, the city of Wuhan, the epicenter is. They've said nobody from Hubei province can come in, and anybody who's been there in the last 14 days is banned unless you can show that you are actually a resident of Hong Kong. Mm-hmm. The health system has already said that just dealing with the number of patients that are suspected cases right now, they're having to set up isolation wards. Everybody that comes in with a flu, they have to potentially test them, and already straining the healthcare system, some people say to the limit. So there's great concern that if the number of actual cases goes up dramatically, things could be quite severe here.
Does it sound like these measures may be too late?
Certainly a lot of health officials are saying that it appears that trying to keep this genie in the bottle is just not working. One official the other day was saying that of the confirmed cases that they have in Hong Kong, he'd been asked whether these are residents of Wuhan or not. And he said, everyone that we are dealing with at the moment is listed as a Chinese citizen. So that means they could be from Hong Kong. It could mean they're from Wuhan. It could mean they're from wherever. Yeah. It's a real issue of trying to figure out who is at the highest risk and try to limit their movement. Obviously, people also want to get out of Wuhan because that city's now under lockdown. People aren't allowed to move around. It sounds like they're having shortages of food in the markets there. Mm. So there's a great incentive for some people to want to get out of Wuhan and come down here to Hong Kong.
Absolutely sounds like a chaotic situation. We know that Lunar New Year is upon us. It's a big holiday season in China and Hong Kong. Yeah. Wuhan's mayor has offered to step down. He and other Communist Party officials have been criticized for responding too slowly. Are you hearing Hong Kong's residents complaining about the mainland's slow response?
I am definitely hearing some of that frustration. I'm also hearing frustration of people not being honest about what their symptoms are when they come into the hospital or where they're coming from. Mm. At the moment, people are just really scared. I was up actually at the border from Hong Kong across the border, Shenzhen. People are coming across. A lot of people have come on the train. And I was talking to people there, and it's almost like panic in some of these towns. People aren't going out at all. People are trying to figure out how to get out. There's great concern here in Hong Kong, and there's great concern north of here in China, where it's really the bulk of the cases that are coming up.
And officials are not calling this a pandemic yet, correct?
Correct. They're not calling it a pandemic, which would sort of imply a global disease outbreak if it was a pandemic. At the moment, they're still arguing that this is limited to China. You've got cases in the United States. There's cases popping up in Europe. Things are coming up all over the place. But in terms of sustained transmission, you're not seeing that, obviously, in many of these other parts of the world. I was talking to some researchers today, and they said that this definitely has the potential to become a global pandemic. Mm. They were predicting in some of their modeling that you could be having 150,000 cases a day in Shaanxing. It's just amazing the volume that potentially could be out there by what some of these epidemiologists are modeling.
Jason, one other thing we're thinking about are the massive protests that we saw in Hong Kong against Beijing's rule. What's happening to those protests? Are people still out in the streets?
Yeah, just even last night, just outside my hotel, there were some violent clashes between police and protesters. Protesters were here in the center of Hong Kong. Further north, the health authorities were trying to set up an isolation center in a housing. It's a public housing estate, and there was this one building that was empty, and they were going to use it as an isolation center for people who were suspected of having the coronavirus. Oh, wow. And people there took into the streets, set up barricades, set fire to the building. Protests are continuing, and certainly this coronavirus is adding to that. I think at first the protesters were holding back, feeling like they didn't necessarily want to get out into the streets in a time when everyone's being told not to gather. But we've seen that change. And yesterday, definitely, there was hundreds of people in the streets, and riot police came out, and there was some violent clashes that happened.
That's NPR's Jason Beaubien in Hong Kong. Jason, thank you so much for this update.
Tanya, you're welcome.
I'm broadcasting from the studios of WUNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina today, exactly 1 week before the Iowa caucuses. You won't find many candidates here in North Carolina yet, but this is sure to be a state that matters come November. North Carolina went to President Obama in 2008 and then to President Trump in 2016. A Democratic governor was elected in 2016, but the state legislature is controlled by Republicans. We're joined now by Jeff Tiberi, Capitol Bureau Chief at WUNC. He's with me here in Chapel Hill. Hi, Jeff.
Good to see you.
And Mary C. Curtis, columnist at Roll Call, is with us from Charlotte, North Carolina. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
So, Mary, this is a state that Obama barely won in 2008, then barely lost in 2012. As I said, President Trump took it in 2016. How competitive is North Carolina going to be in the presidential race in 2020?
Well, it's always going to be very competitive. North Carolina seems to be at the center of the political universe always. And remember, Hillary Clinton lost the state, but only by a little more than 3.5 percentage points. And then you also have this very competitive senators race with Republican Tom Tillis running for reelection. You have the Democratic governor running, Roy Cooper for reelection. Mm-hmm. And then in August, the Republicans will be meeting in Charlotte for the convention to nominate against President Donald Trump. And remember that Charlotte is a very blue city. And so that will be one to watch as well. 15 electoral votes are up for grabs. Mm-hmm. And we have the March 3rd primary date coming up. So,
well,
yes, it will be competitive.
Are you seeing the same thing happening in North Carolina that you see in the state's neighbor to the north, Virginia, which is that there is a more of a blue tint? It's not quite as purple, or is North Carolina different?
It's pretty purple. And as you see in many states, a lot of the cities and more urban areas tend to be very Democratic. In Charlotte, actually, there are no Republicans on the county commission, and the city council is 9-2 Democratic. We have an African-American female Democratic mayor, although everyone's been very welcoming to the convention because it'll be great for business. But you see, the state has been pretty much split, which folks don't realize often because our congressional delegation in the House is 10-3 Republican. But a lot of that has had to do with the gerrymandering, redistricting. And you cannot talk about the vote in North Carolina without bringing up the voter ID bills. After the Supreme Court and the Shelby Holder decision invalidated provisions of the Voting Rights Act, the state, which was the legislature, very Republican, came out with a strict voter ID bill, which has been in and out of the courts. It is back in the courts again. At one point, it was thrown out. Federal courts said it went after African-American voters with almost surgical precision. And so the voters put it back in the state constitution. It amended the constitution. But the new law is back in the courts. So actually, voters will not have to show an ID on March 3rd. And that is very important, too, particularly considering how diverse the state is.
Well, and so that's when the primary is going to be on March 3rd, which is Super Tuesday, a lot of other states as well. Jeff, you heard Mary talk there about the redistricting. What's going on with the maps right now?
Well,
the congressional maps?
There will be new legislative and new congressional maps in these 2020 elections. And Mary, just a moment ago, mentioned the 10-3 congressional split, 10 Republicans, 3 Democrats, despite this being roughly a 50-50 state. Well, they did the redraw back in the fall because the maps were struck down because they were illegal partisan gerrymanders. The expectation is that this will move North Carolina's congressional delegation to 8 Republicans and 5 Democrats, most likely. Democrats are expected to pick up 2 seats. If it's a really good year for Democrats, it's possible that 1 or 2 other seats will be in play as well.
And what about the presidential race? Jeff, are you seeing any candidates come to this state, even though they have to spend so much time in Iowa, New Hampshire, or the impeachment trial in Washington?
So it's an interesting question. We expect to see a lot of visits from candidates. We've seen 25 to 30 aggregate thus far. A longtime political observer said to me recently, if you didn't know any better, you might think that the race here was between Tom Steyer and Michael Bloomberg, because those are the two who right now are spending money and are advertising in the state. Now, neither of them is expected to win North Carolina. So that dynamic likely to shift in the weeks ahead.
Now, Mary, you mentioned the Senate race coming up this year. It is shaping up to be a very expensive race for the incumbent Republican Senator Tom Tillis, who's in Washington for the impeachment trial. And he's already said that he's made up his mind to acquit President Trump. Here he is speaking over the weekend.
Well, I've survived another 8 hours of arguments from Adam Schiff and the Democrat House managers. It's really a Hollywood production. Makes sense for a guy who represents Hollywood. But at the end of the day, it's only a production.
Mary, is sticking with President Trump the right strategy for Tillis in North Carolina, which, as we've been talking about, is pretty split?
Well, you might remember that a little while ago, he wrote a column announcing he would oppose President Trump when he was declaring the national emergency to fund a wall along the border. And he got so much pushback, he actually ended up voting with the president on that. And since then, he has really tethered himself to the president and his policies. In fact, even tweeting during impeachment, "This sham impeachment is a waste of America's time, and the people of North Carolina are getting tired of it," which I suppose we'll see. But I believe he believes it's the best strategy to get the Republican base out and vote for him. Although it looks to be a competitive race right now, there will be a Democratic primary, but the National Democrats have put a lot behind Cal Cunningham, a former state legislator, veteran, and the polls so far look pretty tight.
Mm-hmm. We'll be watching that one. Jeff, one of the political stories here in North Carolina that has gotten a lot of attention all over the country is what happened back in 2016 when Roy Cooper, the Democrat, won the governor's race, and then the Republican legislature immediately passed bills to strip him of some of his power. Here he is when he was governor-elect back in 2016.
Most people might think that this is a partisan power grab, but it is really more ominous. It's really about hurting public education, working families, state employees, health care, and clean air and water.
So he called that a Republican power grab. Then we saw partisanship ramp up again last September. On the anniversary of 9/11, the Democrats were out marking the anniversary, and Republicans took advantage in the legislature and held a surprise vote and overturned a budget veto by the governor. Here's Democratic State Representative Deb Butler in the state capitol responding.
Mr. Speaker, you are making a mockery of this process. You are deceiving all of North Carolina. At this moment in time, you are doing the unspeakable. Is this the legacy you want? Are you proud of this?
Wow. Jeff, have things gotten any better since then in terms of the partisanship? And is Governor Cooper able to govern?
Since when? No, not at all. What we saw late in 2016 was effectively that storm cloud on the horizon, and it was coming. And it's as though you were on the beach and you're thinking, all right, this is going to be a mess. Let's get to the car. Let's pack up. Let's get out of here. Mm-hmm. But there was no car to get to. So we have weathered the storm, and the storm is still here. There is very much a volatile landscape. There's a lot of partisan bickering. And from our reporting, what we understand is that the leaders of the North Carolina legislature, the Republican leaders and the Democratic governor at this point really aren't even conversing. They're not having meaningful discussions. They're not brokering any kind of movement on Medicaid expansion. North Carolina is one of the states that did not expand Medicaid. And we don't have a new state budget right now. So very much still an acrimonious position. The governor now does have a veto that has teeth. So he's been able to, not necessarily to answer your question, govern anymore, mm-hmm. but he has been able to play a little bit more defense.
Mary, what kind of race is he going to be facing this year?
Oh, I think a very competitive race because it is a split state. So I do think you'll have folks coming out, and I've already heard back and forth of what's going to happen. But we'll see if people will be frustrated that they feel that he and his agenda was frustrated, and that will spur them to vote.
Jeff, quickly, I just want to ask you one other story. Mm-hmm. Is that, you know, we've been talking about the trade war with China and the tariffs and how they've hurt farmers, and then the farmers have gotten a bailout from the U.S. government. How's that playing here?
You know, I have not had any recent conversations with farmers. Last summer, I spent several days with soybean and tobacco farmers. They were largely standing with the president, and they said that they felt that what he was doing was necessary, was long overdue, and they continue to stand by him. And unless we do not think that that narrative has changed. Nothing has indicated that.
I want to ask each of you, I love doing this whenever we talk with reporters who cover the states so closely, about a story that we're not paying attention to outside of North Carolina that we ought to be, that's happening here. I'll start with you, Mary. What would you say?
Well, it's so interesting because in North Carolina, so many roads lead to sports, which has impact implications beyond sports. Even with the tragic death of Kobe Bryant, he was drafted by Charlotte, and we've seen a lot of stories. And in Charlotte, David Tepper bought the Panthers. He's bringing soccer to Charlotte, Major League Soccer. And there have been a lot of debates on how much money the city will have to contribute and what it will get for it. So you see the intersection of politics and sports there. Mm-hmm. And we've seen Panthers player Luke Kuechly retiring at 28 after numerous concussions, and what that means for the future, not only of the team, but of sports and of football, and what impact it will have. So it does seem in North Carolina that a lot of roads lead not just to politics,
but to sports as well. Jeff?
We'll get a brief timeout from politics two Saturdays from now, Carolina and Duke. we get it twice a year, and it's a nice respite.
You know, I'm doing an event tonight with WUNC, and I accidentally brought a light blue and white tie, but I think that's going to send a message, and I don't know if I've, you know, I'm an Illini fan, so, but hey, go all teams.
Well played.
My son went to Duke, but just saying.
Okay. Mary C. Curtis, columnist at Roll Call, and Jeff Tiberi, Capital Bureau Chief here at WUNC. Thanks so much to both of you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
When it's too cold to go out or too icy to make it out of the driveway, where do you go to find just the right movie, just the right book, just the right show to binge? Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR can help you keep warm and keep up at the same time. Join us twice a week on Pop Culture Happy Hour.
Those are chants from fans at the Staples Center reacting to the death of retired NBA superstar Kobe Bryant, his 13-year-old daughter, and seven others in a helicopter crash here in Southern California yesterday. For two decades, the entire span of his NBA career, Kobe played for the LA Lakers, his presence felt in just about every stretch of the city. KPCC reporter Eric Galindo is a native Angeleno and once worked for the Lakers TV station, and he joins me now in studio. Eric, welcome.
Hi.
You wrote this heart-wrenching piece for the LAist a few hours after the world learned about Kobe's death. It was raw. It was real. You were crying when you wrote it, and it captured what so many of us were feeling. You were actually in the room with Kobe many times when you worked for the LA Lakers TV station.
This is such a charming guy. He's like so, like he brings you in, he brings everyone in. Like he's tough. He's like, on TV you see him, right? And he's like a ruthless competitor.
He's a ruthless competitor, the grit there of his game and
exactly.
his intensity. You write that Kobe was hope. As a kid growing up here in LA, describe just how much he embodied Los Angeles.
Yeah, man, that's the thing. See, like, people have this misconception of like a misconception of LA, that LA is like this glitz and like the stuff they see on TV. But Kobe was that, right? But Kobe captured the stuff you don't see on TV, which is this gritty, unflappable, ineffable determination that just like there's that saying of like, if you make it in New York, you can make it anywhere. I think that might be true, but I think in LA is like a tough town where failure happens like at every turn, and the only way to get through it is to just be tough and work hard and be resilient. And I think no one captured that more than Kobe. Like, Kobe was LA, like hustle is LA, like trying every morning to achieve something impossible is LA. And I think that's what he captured the most, was just this like this gritty determination to do the impossible, to achieve dreams.
You know, you write, of course, that Kobe Bryant was also a complicated person. You allude to that in your piece, the rape allegations. But you also say it was his complexities and flaws that also made him significant to you and to LA.
Yeah, I think we can love Kobe despite his flaws and hope that, you know, we all can love our own flaws. Like, it's that same thing where, like, I love Kobe like I love LA, flaws and all. There's a lot of despair in this city, but at the same time, there's a lot of joy and there's a lot of beautiful things that happen. And I feel like that's kind of just like this metaphor for life. And if we can see, if we can find the beauty in like these, even in these flawed people, then maybe we can accept ourselves. We can accept our situations a little more. But what I do know is that, like, I'm going to try to take his best examples and try to apply that to my life.
Eric, thank you for talking to us. That's KPCC reporter Eric Galindo. And thanks to KQED for providing the sounds from the Staples Center. Recently in Oakland, a group of mothers occupied a vacant home, highlighting a housing problem that's growing across the U.S. According to a 2019 census report, a little over 12% of units in our country were vacant. An estimated 4,000 parcels are empty in Oakland, a city also grappling with rising homelessness. One solution is a so-called vacancy tax, and we wanted to learn more about how these taxes work. Joining me now for more is Michael Lenz, Associate Professor of Urban Planning and Public Policy at UCLA. Welcome.
Thank you.
So we were all struck by the sheer number of vacant parcels in Oakland, upwards of 4,000, we're hearing. So when folks hear about the possibility of a vacancy tax, it sounds sort of intriguing in the context of what's happening in Oakland with so many empty parcels and homes. How does this work? How does a vacancy tax actually work?
This is not uncharted territory. You've got examples in Vancouver, in Canada, and in Washington, D.C., but we don't have a lot of data to draw on just yet, or experiences. But, you know, the way this would work is you have to have some active data collection on what parcels, what units are vacant out there, and you would like to know a little bit more about why, because vacancies do carry different characteristics. Things are vacant for different reasons. You know, you might have some laws in there about different landowners and treating different landowners differently based on could range from income to where they reside, and things of that nature. So, you know, this is a solution that could take a lot of different forms, I think.
I want to get to something that you just said about the different reasons are really important, because oftentimes high vacancy rates, they're indicative of a low demand for housing. But in some of the places that are actually thinking about this as a solution, including Los Angeles, there are parts of the city where there's a huge demand for it. And yet we're talking about using this as a means, as part of a larger solution. Can you talk about that a little bit more?
Yeah, I think a classic refrain that you hear right now in a hot housing market like Los Angeles is that we're building too many, quote unquote, luxury housing units, right? And so We're only building for a certain market segment at the very top of the income range and the cost and the price range, and we're overbuilding in that sector, and we're not building enough for people who are of lower means. And so, if we're building too much, a lot of that stock goes unused and remains vacant. I think there's still a lot to learn about how frequent that is. You know, a lot of times new housing remains vacant for a period of time while buildings fill up, whether that's, you know, leasing up or selling condos. So we have to collect good data and timely data to know exactly what is vacant, for how long, why, and, you know, is there some reason to believe that there is land speculation that is driving, you know, some of this vacancy.
I want to ask you about another place, Detroit, where 16% of homes are vacant. And the Detroit Land Bank has become the owner of thousands of foreclosed homes. It's a different situation, of course. But how does it help us understand what situations can or can't be fixed by a vacancy tax?
Right. So the story in Detroit is often that you may have, you know, bought this house 20, 30 years ago, and it's impossible to sell, you know, above, say, $50,000, $100,000, and that's not going to make up for the amount that you've lost, or you're underwater on a loan or something like that. And so hanging on to a vacant property in that situation, hoping that at some point things turn around, is a very different process, but mirrors really what we think of as speculation, right? Where in a hot market, the speculator is holding on to something that they hope they can sell at a profit later on. But, you know, in one case, we've got, say, a grandmother in Detroit, and the other case, we've got a foreign investor in Los Angeles. We want to treat those two people very differently, but they might be hoping for the same outcome at the end.
Mm-hmm. Housing has always been a story about race and economics.
Absolutely.
How does a vacancy tax get at the core issue, or does it at all?
I think it's a good time to reflect on MLK's legacy, certainly in the context of the housing question, right? And later in his career, he was did a lot of work on housing segregation, particularly later in his career. And I think this is the vacancy tax is another colorblind solution to a problem that involves race very commonly, right? If you think about eviction, if you think about homelessness, if you think about the negative impacts of segregation, both by race and class in our housing markets, this is a problem that is often very concentrated in particular communities amongst households of color. And so a vacancy tax is not getting at those root problems. It's not getting at those root causes that go back to Martin Luther King's time and before, right? And, you know, that some of these a vacancy tax can have some positive outcomes for people who are struggling the most if we use the money that the tax would raise in an appropriate way. But again, it's not getting at the root causes of our housing problems, which are myriad, but certainly have a lot to do with race.
Yeah. What are some of the pushbacks against a vacancy tax?
Well, some of the pushback that you get is the pushback that you would get for any tax, right? That there are already too many taxes for too many purposes, right? And people are overburdened, whether they're landowners or not. And also, you can scare away investment that you might actually want.
Mm.
That can move across borders pretty easily if a city is the implementer of a tax like this.
So a developer, for instance, who might want to develop a high rise, but knowing that they have to be assured that they actually have occupancy, mm-hmm. and they know there's a vacancy tax within that municipality, might just say, oh, I'll go to this other city.
Exactly. So geographic boundaries are much smaller, and the cost of moving from Los Angeles to Culver City or Beverly Hills to do your property investment is a lot lower than if, you know, the state of California said, we're going to do a vacancy tax. And so then everybody in the LA metro area, everybody in the San Francisco area would be subject to that. And so you couldn't easily move across borders in that way.
Yeah. You're thinking very deeply about this all of the time. What are some very tangible ways that we can really get at this issue of housing inequity?
Well, I think the time is right now to directly target people who are struggling the most in a more generous way. We do not allow housing subsidies to be considered an entitlement, right? We do not give people housing subsidies if they qualify all of the time, right? We have long waiting lists for lotteries to get into public housing, to get into other below market rate housing, to obtain vouchers for affording a home. And we have these massive homelessness crises, and we can't build fast enough to accommodate that. But we also need to build faster, right? And so I think subsidies, increased supply, and trying to protect tenants in the places where they are, whether that is through eviction defense, rent control, other means of protecting tenants where they are and making sure they don't have to move.
Yeah. And on a human level, really thinking beyond who deserves housing and who doesn't, because fundamentally that's what race comes down to. That's what the issue of class comes down to, is in a capitalist society, who we think deserves based on their worth.
Right. And I don't think we've resolved that question in housing in particular. You know, there's always been a strong movement that housing is a human right. But we tend to protect property interests and property as something that people earn in ways that are not universal.
That's Michael Lenz, Associate Professor of Urban Planning and Public Policy and Director of the Lewis Center for Regional Policy Studies. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tanya.
We are 1 week away from the Iowa caucuses, and a new poll from Emerson College shows Bernie Sanders in the lead there. He is backed by 30% of respondents, 9 points ahead of second place Joe Biden. Sanders is relying on support from younger voters because some of his ideas, like democratic socialism, do not poll well with older Americans. And Derek Thompson sees some irony there. Derek is senior editor at The Atlantic, and he joins us from Washington, as he does each Monday. Hi, Derek.
Hey, Jeremy.
So first off, how does polling on socialism break down by age?
Older Americans are vastly more likely to say that they prefer capitalism over socialism. If you look at Americans over 55, for example, it's a 2-to-1 margin in favor of capitalism over socialism. That's according to polling by Gallup. But if you ask Americans born after 1980, millennials and Generation Z, they are equally likely to say that they feel positively about both capitalism and socialism. It basically breaks down 50-50. So a 2-to-1 margin among boomers, a 50-50 split among millennials.
And you find this ironic because you write that these older anti-socialist Americans already live in a wonderland of government generosity, very similar to the socialism that they dread.
Sure. Let's take two examples. I think there's a lot of older Americans, even older Democrats, who say, you know, young people want single payer health care. They want socialized medicine. They want free money from the government. What's that all about? Well, look, the federal government already guarantees single payer health care in the United States. It's called Medicare, and it applies to Americans over the age of 65. Senior citizens already receive a certain kind of universal basic income that's called Social Security. And you could also say, well, there's a lot of older Americans those who say that we shouldn't find new ways to subsidize student debt. We shouldn't pay back young people for student debt that they've accrued. But a lot of these older Americans are homeowners. And every decade, homeowners, average age of 55 in America, receive about $900 billion in mortgage debt subsidies through the mortgage interest deduction right. in the tax code. So what I'm pointing out here is that Sanders, you could say, is not so much offering his young constituency a radically new contract. What he's saying is that we already have in the United States a mixed economy, a little bit of capitalism and a little bit of socialism, and he wants to extend the terms of that existing contract to more Americans. And because older Americans tend to live in a somewhat socialist world already, that means extending the contract to younger Americans.
Well, and at the same time, the economic picture is very different for younger Americans than it is for older Americans when it comes to jobs and debt.
That's absolutely right. You know, I've been on this show many times talking about how the economy is getting better, even though a lot of people aren't necessarily talking about it at the Democratic Party. And that's true. In many ways, the rate of growth in the U.S. economy is pretty good, and this has been a long recovery. But in November, the Conference Board, which is this non-governmental research organization, reported on the economic confidence levels in this country. And they found that the gap in economic confidence between consumers under 35 and consumers over 55 was the largest on record, the largest on record, this age gap in confidence in the economy. And I think that's because a lot of young people in this economy feel like they did everything right. They went to college. They took on some debt. They were ready to get a high-paying job to help buy them a house and start a family. But a lot of those parts of the long road of young adulthood were either stalled by the Great Recession or hurt by the lack of affordable housing. And young people in this country are much less likely to be homeowners than their parents or even than Gen X was at the same age. So for many reasons, I think, they look at this situation, they see that modern capitalism has broken the process of becoming a young adult.
That is Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. And we are talking about this, by the way, just a week ahead of the Iowa caucuses. We will be broadcasting from Iowa later this week as we continue to follow the campaign, which we really don't know how it's going to turn out next Monday. But Derek, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And as we close out this hour, we want to take a moment to listen to some of the tributes to basketball legend Kobe Bryant, who died yesterday in that helicopter crash north of Los Angeles. In San Antonio, the Spurs and Raptors opened their NBA game last night by running out the 24-second shot clock, a nod to Bryant's jersey number.
They have decided that whoever wins the tip, and in this case Toronto, they are going to let the shot clock run out because of the number 24 to honor Kobe Bryant. As Fred VanVleet holding on to it, and the crowd recognizing what this means.
Several other teams opened their games the same way last night, and at the Grammy Awards, which took place at the Staples Center where the Lakers play, Alicia Keys and Boyz II Men honored Kobe Bryant this way. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.
2 years we love you, Kobe. Boyz II Men.